In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
The way you get your news may have changed during this pandemic, but you still need to know what's going on in our state every day. IPR News has you covered. Subscribe to our new podcast, Here First, and start your day equipped with the essential local news you need to know, delivered in under 15 minutes, weekdays by 7 a.m. Get analysis from IPR's team of reporters. Learn about what's going on at the Statehouse and on the ground in your community. Subscribe to Here First today, wherever you get your podcasts.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Much in store for you this hour. Sort of a news buzz edition, even though it's Thursday. Quick conversations. Doug Burns of the Carroll Times-Herald will be along to talk about the tech needs of rural Iowa. Also, what is that guy doing under your car? We'll talk about the spike in catalytic converter thefts with the Des Moines Register investigative reporter Daniel Lathrop. And how getting a shot in the arm can be an emotional experience. I'll talk with an RN in southwest Iowa, in Clarinda, who's given hundreds of COVID shots. But first, the Drake University Bulldogs and the University of Iowa Hawkeyes kick off their first games this week in the NCAA men's basketball tournament. March Madness is upon us. And with us, Mark Emmert, Iowa Hawkeyes beat reporter for the Des Moines Register and the Iowa City Press Citizen. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm fine. Do I understand that you're in Indiana in West Lafayette, there awaiting the Drake game this evening?
Yeah, they tip off in, about 5 hours against Wichita State in the first game of the tournament.
Oh, wow. Okay. Before we get to talk about the Bulldogs and the Hawkeyes games, tell us how the NCAA tournament is working this year. All games are in Indiana, but not in the same location.
Yeah, they're using six different venues. This is actually the home of the Purdue Boilermakers that they're playing in tonight. Very limited fan attendance. I think there's going to be 1,350 fans let into the game tonight. That's 9% of capacity. I'm not sure how they arrived at that number, but there's two games being played here tonight and two others being played in Bloomington, Indiana. And then there's four sites being used in Indianapolis itself.
Mm-hmm. Other precautions, are teams, for instance, doing an NBA-like a bubble experience with the players?
That's essentially what it is. Yeah, they're all kind of confined to their hotel rooms. It's one player per hotel room. They're not allowed to leave the building without supervision. Basically, they get all their meals delivered to their room. They just go to games and practices and back to their room. So when I talked to the Hawkeyes this week, they were very, very, very bored.
All right. And as with the NBA, let's talk a little bit about the NCAA business. The business here is driving this. This is a big moneymaker, this tournament, right? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's by far their biggest moneymaker of the year. And when they lost it last year, that was, you know, roughly $1 billion in revenue loss. For Iowa itself, it was $3.5 million that the Iowa Hawkeyes lost out of their athletic department budget. So you can extrapolate that by 350 different schools that kind of get money out of this thing, plus the TV networks. So that's why we knew all along that they were going to have a tournament this year. They're not going to miss that 2 years in a row because that would be devastating. So they did whatever they could to get this tournament in, and it's here now, and it looks like it's going to be played. There are, you know, still being players being tested every day, so it's possible then that we could have a game forfeited if anybody tests positive for COVID from now on. But right now, 68 teams are here. They all think they're going to play their games, and I'm sure the fans on TV are really, really eager to see those.
Mm-hmm. So in any team, if one player tests positive, the team is out for that game.
Well, that player is out for sure. And then it's a question of who he's around and what the contact tracing would be. So, you know, it's possible, you know, there's a minimum number of players they have to play a game. So, you know, there are actually teams that are here that had to leave one player at home. Like Kansas did that. I think Virginia is coming in not until today, because they had COVID issues back on their campus. So those guys will be able to play if the team advances another week. They have to sit out 1 week. They could come fly out here next week if their team is still alive. But it's just that kind of tenuous situation where you're not going to be sure from day to day, yeah, you know, which games are going to get played and then who's going to be available to play in those games.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about the actual games that involved the Iowa teams. Explain this first four. Drake is in the tournament, but it's not in the round of 64, right?
Yeah, they added four teams to the tournament a few years back, and to 68, and obviously that's not a number that you can break down evenly in a tournament in a single elimination format. So they created what they call the first four, which is basically four teams that have to play one additional game if they're to advance. And Drake was a very, very last team to get in this field this year. They barely made it. So they're in this first four against Wichita State. They're both seeded as 11 seeds right now. If they win, the winner will go on and play USC on Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so what do you have your eyes on for tonight's game, Drake against Wichita State?
Well, Drake is 25-4. They're coming off one of their best seasons ever. They haven't been in this tournament in 13 years. They haven't won a game in this tournament in 52 years since they went to the Final Four in 1969. So a pretty milestone moment for this team. And Darren DeVries just got an 8-year contract extension yesterday, the coach. So they feel like they're trending in the right direction. They're getting one of their better players back tonight. Tank Hemphill has been out for 9 games with a broken foot. He's actually their leading scorer at 14 points a game. So I don't have the data in front of me, Ben, but anecdotally, I would think that anytime you get a guy named Tank back for the postseason, that's probably a good thing. And they're a really good 3-point shooting team, 37%. They're very balanced. They got 6 guys averaging between 8 and 14 points. So it's a really fun team to watch typically. And, it's really a question now if their 3-point shots are falling or not.
Yeah. And how do you size up Wichita State?
Yeah, they're another team. They fired their coach early in the year. They had a big controversy. Greg Marshall was accused of abusing players, and he got let go. He'd been there a long time. So it's kind of interesting to see that they kind of righted the ship under an assistant coach who's an interim coach here. A much bigger team than Drake. They have more size, they'll be more physical. So it really is going to come down to, whether Wichita State's size is the difference in the game or Drake's outside shooting and kind of their speed.
Okay, that game tonight, as you said, at the Purdue University's Mackey Arena there, where the Boilermakers are at home. Okay, let's shift our view to the Hawkeyes. Tell us more about the region the Hawkeyes are in. What does their path to the Final Four look like and some of their top opponents in that region?
Yeah, they're in the West region, which doesn't really mean anything this year because they're all here in Indiana, but that means that Gonzaga out of Spokane, Washington is the number one seed. They're the number one overall seed in the whole tournament. They're undefeated. So that's probably the best team in America. Drake already lost to them in December, you may remember. And again, it was not particularly competitive. But first up, Drake's a 2 seed for the first time since 1987. So that's obviously one of the best seasons in school history. They're going to open up against Grand Canyon University out of Phoenix, which is making its first ever appearance in this tournament. It's only been a Division I school for 8 years. So they're seeded 15. Drake is favored by 16 points on Saturday. So you think they should win that, but obviously there have been 8-15 seeds that have won games here in the last 35 years, so it's not, nothing is impossible. But Drake should have an easy time there, I would think, and then they would play either the winner of Oregon or VCU.
You mean the Hawkeyes? The Hawkeyes,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
go ahead.
And they would play either Oregon or VCU on Monday, and then if they win that, Kansas is actually the 3 seed here. Obviously, that's a really, really good program, so that would be a tough game potentially for Drake down the road, but right now it's Grand Canyon and a team that I really don't know a lot about, but it'll be a pretty interesting matchup, I think, on Saturday at 5:25.
Okay, so to the Hawkeyes, as someone who's been covering the Hawkeyes all season, what do you think will be the keys for the Hawkeyes to advance deep into this tournament run?
Well, they're another team that has to get its 3-point shooting down. They came here last weekend in the Big Ten tournament and made only 2 of 20 3-pointers in their first game, which was really poor for them. But I think they will get that right. And they obviously have to play better defense. That's been the key to them coming forward this whole season. But they've got 3 really veteran players that are probably making their last appearance in Iowa uniforms this weekend or this month. And they definitely want to go out on top. They've been talking about this for 2 years. It's been their goal. So I think it's a very focused team, a very veteran team, a really balanced team. They got obviously the best player in the country inside, and Luka Garza at center, averaging 24 points a game. But Jordan Bohannon is the all-time assist leader at Iowa. He's also the all-time 3-point leader at Iowa. And then Joe Wieskamp is a really, really good junior wing player. And Wieskamp and Garza are probably both headed to the NBA after the season. So they got some high-level talent here. They've got a lot of guys that have had a lot of experience. I think it's a really good team built to make a run here. And I think a lot of fans have been looking forward to this for a long time. This is a once-in-a-generation Hawkeye team.
Mm-hmm. There may be a conflict of interest here, so answer accordingly. You are the Hawkeyes, Iowa Hawkeyes beat reporter for the Des Moines Register and the Iowa City Press Citizen, but What does your bracket look like? Will you get in trouble if you say who's going to win the whole thing?
No, you know what? I've got Gonzaga winning the whole thing. I think a lot of people do. I kind of thought that all year. I saw them play in person up there in South Dakota when they beat Iowa. They got three of the top 15 players in the country on that roster. Really good coach in Mark Few. I think they are right now the best team in the country. Illinois has a good argument as well, but it would take a big upset for them to lose, which, you know, it does happen in this tournament. We know that. And no one has gone undefeated in college basketball since 1976. They're trying to make that history as well. I do think they're the best team, but, you know, sometimes the best team has a bad night and gets beat by somebody. But for right now, I'm picking Gonzaga.
Okay. From bad nights to bad ends of seasons, this week we heard the news at ISU that Steve Prohm is out as the ISU men's basketball coach. Just finished his sixth season, his worst since arriving. Iowa State finishing, 2-22 overall, winless in the Big 12, losing 18 games in a row to end the season. Thoughts there on the ISU rebuild to come?
Yeah, it's going to be a really challenge. They announced officially this morning that T.J. Otzelberger is going to be the new coach. He was a former assistant there under Fred Hoiberg back in the day, and most recently was coaching at Nevada Las Vegas. But I think the situation with Prohm, obviously, that's a historically bad year. I think it's the worst season they've had in a century at Iowa State. But there's really nothing there to suggest that next year would be any better. You know, they really don't have much of a roster. They didn't have a lot of, you know, they got one high-level recruit that's supposed to be coming in. We'll see if he still decides to do that. So it didn't look like the future was going to be any better. I think even Athletic Director Jamie Pollard indicated the fans need to be patient here. This is going to be not a one-year turnaround. It's going to take 3 or 4 years to get that program back to where it was, and they think T.J. Otzelberger is the guy to do it.
Yeah, and what happened under Prohm? He had his team go to the NCAA tournament, and then this.
Yeah, I think it was recruiting. I mean, obviously, when he first got there, a lot of those guys were there under Hoiberg, who left him a pretty good team. And then he lost some guys in the NBA. Tyrese Halliburton is now one of the best players in the NBA. As a rookie, he was a guy that came out of Iowa State early. So he couldn't sustain the recruiting, to withstand the guys leaving early. And it just kind of collapsed on him. And the Big 12 is a really tough league. I mean, you can get bad in a hurry, as we just seen in Ames. So to me, maybe he just wasn't ready to be a high-level coach like that. He came out of Murray State. And maybe that's probably why he'll end up going back to a school maybe of that caliber.
Okay, Mark Emmert, have a blast at the game tonight there in Indiana, where the Drake Bulldogs play in the first game of the NCAA tournament. Mark, always good to talk with you. We'll look for your reporting. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, do you feel your small-town community, if you live in one, has been left out of the new high-tech economy? Doug Burns has been writing about bringing the software revolution to rural Iowa. Doug Burns is co-owner, columnist with the Carroll Times-Herald. He's a fourth-generation Iowa journalist and a member of several rural Iowa economic development boards. Doug Burns, welcome back to our program.
Ben, thanks for having me.
This is interesting what you've been writing about, the work of a California congressman named Ro Khanna and how he's made it his mission to bring the software revolution to rural Iowa, but also Minnesota, rural parts of West Virginia. Tell us more about him, why you focused on writing about him and his relevancy for us now and in the future.
Well, you're right, Ben. It really is a regional story. That's why I think the piece you're referencing was in the Minneapolis Star Tribune last week. Congressman Khanna was essential in getting a branch or a forge of the Accenture software development company that has an operation in Des Moines in Jefferson. So he's been involved here for about 2.5 years. He's been relentless and consistent, and essentially his thinking is this. He's, because Google, Facebook, so many of the big tech operations are rivering out and have their tentacles in our economies and cultures all over the country, Ro Khanna is in a sense sort of really the first national congressman. And his belief is that with all the wealth that's being scooped and segregated out of Carroll, Iowa, and other parts of the country to Silicon Valley, Austin, and Boston, then unless there's some reciprocity, unless we share in some of that digital wealth and modern career growth, that the fabric of the country is going to you know, continue to be torn apart.
Right. And he it sounds like in your writing, he sees a connection between this work of these big tech companies and the culture wars going on, the culture war going on in the U.S., rural versus urban, right?
That's right, and he really sees it in the context of job and wealth creation, not getting into cancel culture and how the platforms are sort of managed or regulated. He's coming at it. He certainly understands that those topics, but he's really coming at it from the perspective of our democracy really isn't sustainable if you have these pockets of extreme wealth. And then you have areas of the country, largely rural reaches, that are left behind, and you have people dislocated, really through no fault of their own, just because of the march of technology. And as COVID has shown us, you know, people don't have to work in urban clusters. They can be decentralized. Somebody could work in, and we're finding that right now in Jefferson. Accenture has people working remotely. With jobs that have California level salaries, but those people can live right here in rural Iowa and contribute to the economy, and keep our schools full of kids, and just as important, get involved in civic life.
Mm-hmm. And Representative Ro Khanna of California has made several visits to Iowa with these ends in mind.
I've driven all over the state with him, and he's really focused on rural areas. But we've been in Mason City, we've been in Fort Dodge, and we've been in Knoxville as well. So, and then of course he's been in other states. So, he's been at this for a few years, and he's really really consistent with his follow up. And sort of the neat thing is, you know, who would have thought, particularly in this current environment with how fractured the country is, that there'd be dozens of people in Jefferson, Iowa, a handful of people in Knoxville that are on a first name basis with Congressman Ro Khanna. We call him Ro. So here's the congressman from the most powerful economic congressional district in the history of the United States, and he cares about what happens on the northeast side of the town square in Jefferson.
Okay. We know politics is talk, but it's also about doing. What has Representative Khanna been doing specifically in Iowa? Has he really moved things?
Absolutely, yeah. So that's part of the strategy too. We really have to win back trust in this country, and you don't do that by coming in and rolling out a 10-point plan that then gets put on the shelf or gets you one story. So he's actually helped get apprenticeships set up in Jefferson for Accenture. He's helped get high-tech computer language scholarships through Des Moines Area Community College. There are people involved in that here in Carroll. And more recently, he was able to get a private foundation that's tied to Google in Silicon Valley to provide a $1.1 million private nonprofit grant. So this isn't money coming out of the USDA. This is money coming from wealthy people in his district, philanthropic-minded people in his district, to Iowa State for a program that promotes prairie strips, the advancement of prairie strips, which, that's the technological function, but it also leads to improved bottom lines for farmers. And I know that Congressman Khanna, I mean, look, he can be on almost any committee, any congressional committee he wants, right? He chose to be on the House Agriculture Committee and regularly talks with Tom Vilsack. So, and he's doing all these things in, we've been in Fort Dodge and Mason City, but he's in a lot of smaller communities where he's quietly getting the work done and, actually bringing deliverables to bear for us.
Mm-hmm. Not only a relationship with Tom Vilsack, our new ag secretary, new old, you know what I mean?
Right.
but also, as you write on Biden's, the president's radar as well.
Yes. Before Biden was here before the caucuses, and I had an opportunity to interview him three times. And we talked about this tech to rural initiative that Congressman Khanna is involved with, and Tom Vilsack happened to be sitting at the table with then candidate Biden, and we spoke at some length about it. And through Vilsack, Mr. Biden was already very, very aware of what Congressman Khanna has been doing.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting. Let me read a couple sentences from that opinion piece in the Star Tribune that you wrote. I spy similarities between Khanna and another American politician, President Barack Obama. They make issues of race not into finger-pointing opportunities, the politics of gotcha. They are aspirational. Now, we didn't mention Ro Khanna is an Indian American, right? And this is, you know, he's encountered the hurdles that you do when you are a person of color growing up in a white majority.
Yes, that's right. And he's been able to thread that needle very much in the manner of Obama, where, again, the word I used was aspirational. I saw him speak to a large group of people in Greene County, and there would have been people from surrounding counties that came in. So it would have been an area that's at this point largely red. But these are people that just we have a sense that because of big tech that like we're just being left behind and we don't really understand why, and Silicon Valley and these wealthier enclaves that are heavy in tech that they just don't understand or care about us. Well, here's Congressman Khanna, standing, in front of a crowd of several hundred people. And again, afterwards, there was a long line of people to talk to him because he brought in a message of economic hope. He brought in a message that was practical. And, then he went into, this software branch that's in an 1880s building on the northeast side of the square in Jefferson, that he helped deliver. So he's, he's literally walking through brick and mortar, that he helped put there. Well, it was an 1880s building that he helped, be retrofitted.
Before we go, we have just a minute for your answer here, Doug, but yeah. I have to ask you about this week that the Iowa Senate Republicans passed that bill to ban tax breaks in government contracts for major tech companies that are found by a court to have improperly censored protected speech. Now, Republican backers of the bill believe the social media companies are unfairly targeting conservative accounts when they try to root out misinformation. Quickly, how does that fit into this conversation?
Well, I mean, Kellyanne Conway used to talk about alternative facts, and I think some of the people behind this bill are working with an alternative constitution. I read the language, and a court would have to determined that somebody was violating protected speech. Well, the government can do that, but private businesses certainly have talking points and a communication strategy. So I don't understand how anybody under this legislation would ever get designated, as a violator according under the Senate bill.
Mm-hmm.
And I do wonder. I doubt this was the intent of the Republican drafters of the legislation, but there's still a lot of state and local tax incentive money that's out there that hasn't been sent to some of these large tech companies. So I suppose if you could somehow catch somebody in a violation, would that mean that for some of these large tech companies that have presences here, that they would cities, counties in the state would be able to pull promised tax credit?
Well, we will find out. Doug Burns, we've got to go. Thanks for the conversation.
Hey,
of the Carroll Times Herald. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
The legislative session is scheduled for 110 days. There will be hundreds of bills proposed this year.
I would like to call the subcommittee meeting to order.
From subcommittees to committees.
I really want to support this bill.
To the chamber floor.
Every senator has voted. The secretary will close the voting system.
Our weekly podcast, Under the Golden Dome, walks you through the legislative process. I'm John Pimple. Subscribe to Under the Golden Dome with your podcast listening program or hear it at iowapublicradio.org.
Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. cats are being stolen in increasing numbers in Iowa and across the country. Not the type of cat you may have in your lap. Cat is also salvage yard shorthand for catalytic converter. These are exhaust emission control devices in cars that reduce toxic gases, pollutants in the exhaust gas. Let's learn about these thefts from Daniel Lathrop. He is an investigative reporter with the Des Moines Register. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ben. It's great to be here.
Tell us about the spike in catalytic converter thefts. How much of an increase are we talking?
They have quadrupled last year from the year before, and they're on track to blow that away in the next 12 months. There have been hundreds just in the Des Moines area, probably thousands of thefts around the state this year.
And you've spoken with the mechanics in the Des Moines area. I see in your article at the Hilltop Tire Service in Des Moines. So this has meant extra business for mechanics, hasn't it?
It has. It's business that they all say they'd rather not have. They don't like seeing their customers coming in having to deal with the results of this theft. It can cost, you know, more than $1,000, depending on the car, sometimes even $2,000 out of pocket to get your catalytic converter replaced. Thieves, they resell them on the black market for about $100.
Okay, so what is so special about these things? And if you look at them, they can look, there are variations of them, but they can look like a large, very large loaf of bread in terms of the shape. Of course, they're metal, they're under your car, in your exhaust system. Why are they so valuable right now, and why are they increasing? Have they been increasing in value, evidently enough for thieves to take a lot of interest?
Well, they contain two relatively rare metals, valuable metals. One is palladium and one is rhodium. And rhodium has increased over the past several years from its price being measured in the hundreds of dollars to being more than $20,000 an ounce. So that's really the driving factor. Palladium has also increased substantially, but not as much as rhodium.
And so these stolen catalytic converters, where do they likely go? Do they find the sort of those precious metals washed out of them, taken out of them somewhere, and then sold on a black market?
A lot of times, actually, what happens is they are sort of because the new catalytic converters are very expensive because of the metals. Often what the fences and the criminal organizations will do is they will make them look new again and then resell them to mechanics and parts dealers as if they were new.
So as you pointed out in your article, it's possible you may get your catalytic converter stolen, have to pay hundreds, if not $1,000, to have one replace it, and that replacement could be a stolen one?
It could be. It depends on your mechanic, obviously. Most mechanics get theirs from, you know, I would say reputable sources, and people don't install used catalytic converters. But yeah, these stolen catalytic converters are snuck back into the supply chain.
Yeah, and you spoke with the head of the National Insurance Crime Bureau and sort of put this in the context, the nationwide context here. What's going on? What's being done about it? How can this be stemmed?
Well, there's no great way to stop this. So it takes just minutes under a car with a Sawzall to cut one of these out, and the thief is there and down and gone. So unless they're literally spotted in the act, they're very rarely caught. One of the places they do get caught is they will they will often break into salvage yards and steal them off of wrecked cars, or they'll break into commercial truck parking lots. That's a very common one. And there they may get caught because of surveillance cameras, because they're there longer, getting multiple things. But the truth is, if someone doesn't see them in the act, they almost never get caught.
Yeah, and I saw in your article you talked with Tom Yaw of Yaw's Auto Salvage in Des Moines, and he said he regularly has thieves saw holes in the fence around his salvage yard to get at these cars, right?
Oh, yeah. No, they cut right through the fence. You know, it's a chain link fence. It's not hard to cut through if you're a criminal. And and they'll go in and they'll get everything that's there. They'll cut them off the wrecks. They'll cut them off cars that have been towed. They'll cut them off new cars that people that are parked overnight in the parking lot. They'll just hit everything that's there. And, you know, he's probably had over $100,000 in stolen catalytic converters in the last year.
And in your article, you named a Des Moines man who's been a defendant charged with more than 30 times. If you can do it 30 times, I think he pleaded guilty, you said, at least once there in Jasper County. we need higher penalties, perhaps, if you can do it this many times and keep going.
Yeah, you know, it is considered a theft, not a burglary, because it is on the outside of the car. And right now, the penalties are fairly modest. It is generally going to be considered a simple misdemeanor. It's like shoplifting in terms of the penalties, because a lot of the cost of the replacement is not the value of the catalytic converter. It's the cost to have it installed. About 20 states, including Iowa, have been looking at finding ways to increase the penalties or decrease the frequency of this. I'm told by Brian Meyer from the legislature, Des Moines Democrat, that he is working across the aisle with Republicans to hold hearings possibly as soon as the next legislative session in order to try and come up with some legislative solutions that might act to discourage this.
Thanks for your reporting and getting us up to date on the increase in stolen cats in Iowa and across the country. By that, of course, we mean once again that salvage yard shorthand for catalytic converter. Daniel Lathrop, investigative reporter with the Des Moines Register, thanks so much.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we heard the big news yesterday, especially for those of us waiting for a shot in the arm, myself included. Yesterday, Governor Reynolds announced all Iowans could be eligible for the COVID-19 vaccine by April 5th. One very important condition, though, the state's vaccination allocation must increase as much as the federal government anticipates. Reynolds said the White House told her this week they expect to significantly ramp up doses starting the week of March 29th. That's in just about 10 days from now. This could double the state's current weekly supply. And we know getting a long-awaited vaccine shot during this deadly pandemic is different for different people. For some, it's a moment of uncertainty. For many, it's an incredible relief, even joy. Sometimes I've heard stories of an unexpectedly emotional experience getting a shot. That's for those on the receiving end of the needle. But what's it been like for those on the giving end, for those healthcare workers administering the doses to grateful Iowans? Kelsey Allen joins me. She's occupational and employee health nurse at Clarinda Regional Health Center in Southwest Iowa. Kelsey, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Good to have you and learn about your experience. I understand you've been an RN for over 15 years.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what's been happening lately. How many COVID doses have you put into arms, would you say?
Well, I was happy to do all of the employees here at Clarinda Regional Health Center that wanted one, and we gave about 450 shots total. We've also been helping our local public health office administer shots to the public as well, just sending nurses to increase the amount given per day.
Mm-hmm. So many hundreds of shots you have personally given.
Yes.
What's that experience been like for you? You feel a little bit like a superhero?
You know, it was interesting. The first day that they arrived here, it was a lot of excitement, just that they were in the door and they were in our building. And you don't really think about the impact that it has until you go home that night and you think, wow, that was a changing day for our little area of Southwest Iowa. And, you know, just knowing that's the start of good things, and we're all hoping to get back to normal, and that was kind of the start of that. So a lot of excitement and just a sense of relief, I think, for a lot of people.
Right. So do you get, talk about the reactions you get from the people. I imagine for some it's just like a flu shot or something like that, but for some it's different. What is the range of reactions you've been getting?
It's been mostly positive. I think there's been a lot of people that feel that way. It's just a flu shot, and this is what we need to do to get back in the swing of things again. But some, it just took a little more education. And, you know, yes, there might be some side effects, but, hey, they're 24 hours versus something that could be deadly or last a lot longer than 24 hours. So, you know, we had some hesitancy, but then we had a lot of people come around there towards the end, too.
Mm-hmm. So you say education. So the most common questions from those who are hesitant are what?
I think just not knowing the side effects that would come. You know, it was all new here. And so I think they wanted to see those first few get their shots first and see kind of see how they reacted. And then they were on board. So,
yeah. Have you had any recipients of the shots who are just off the charts joyful?
Oh, absolutely. So a lot of our employees just felt a huge sense of security, knowing we could work, we could be a little safer working with those patients who were ill. And then we also were happy to give some of our volunteers here that help out at the hospital their shots. And a lot of them are over the age 65. And so I think, you know, they got theirs a little sooner than the rest of that age bracket. We had a lady in particular only has one lung, and she was terrified to be outside. And so as the volunteer, she got to come in and get her shot, and she was just, when that second shot was done, you could tell she was just relieved, knowing I'm that much safer.
I know someone here, around 60, who got a shot and was unexpectedly just sitting in the chair, getting the shot, crying. And the nurse said to her, "That's okay. We see that." Mm-hmm. Do you see that? Do you see that?
Yeah, I think it's been people just so joyful, really, that the opportunity was there for them. And, you know, a lot of those volunteers that were older, like, "Oh, I get to see my grandkids again sooner than I thought." And, you know, that's huge for them, to have those relationships back in a face-to-face manner. So,
mm-hmm. I don't know if you pay attention to politics or polls. We heard in the polls this week that more Republicans than Democrats say they will not get a shot. It's quite significant, or they're unsure about it. In Southwest Iowa, do you see any clues that might be true in talking with people in your community? I don't want to drag you into politics, but when you see a poll like that, is that like, yeah, that makes sense?
I think Southern Iowa, it's a small town. We're small town areas, and I think there's just hesitancy in certain groups. I don't really ask for politics here, but
sure.
You know, I think people will get it down here regardless of party. I think we're all ready just to get back out to doing normal things again and go to concerts and enjoy our families again without the fear of the disease.
Sure. And you mentioned that some are waiting for others. Do you see that it's in your community that those who perhaps were hesitant at the first are checking in with neighbors, other community members, and they're saying, oh, okay, yeah, I guess I will do it, after being rather hesitant at first.
Absolutely. I think anything that's just unknown is scary, and this has all been very unknown for everyone. So the disease itself, and then these vaccines rolling out. So I think as the numbers grow higher, people that have been vaccinated, there's also the sense of relief of, oh, they had both shots and they're okay.
Yep.
So maybe it's okay for me.
And actually, they look a little less stressed, maybe, too.
Right, right.
Kelsey, to widen this out before we say goodbye to you, I wonder, when this pandemic is in the history books, and we hope that will be very soon, and we will return to some sense of normalcy the way it used to be in our communities, do you think in your healthcare center that there will be any practices, anything you've learned, adaptations you've made that will stick?
I think so. I think any business really has learned to figure out different ways to approach these situations. And so we started a lot of telehealth visits, and I think those will continue. I think that we've realized how much of a benefit that is to so many of our patients, to be able just to see a provider over a screen, to check in and make sure they're doing okay. So I think that those kinds of things will remain, and I think that's a great thing. There's a lot of things we've learned from this pandemic too that'll be beneficial down the road. So
okay, wonderful. Kelsey Allen, an RN, she's at Clarinda Regional Health Center in Southwest Iowa. Kelsey, thank you so much for giving us a snapshot from your part of the state. Keep up the great work putting shots in arms.
Yeah, thank you.
Time enough at the end of this edition of River to River for a preview of this evening's performance of the Des Moines by the Des Moines Symphony. Joining us, Maestro Joseph Junta of the Des Moines Symphony. Maestro Junta, welcome to the program.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
We have a few minutes here. What will be performed this evening? And we'll let our listeners know how they can join and listen in.
Yeah, we have four pieces that we're going to be playing. Two of these pieces were written primarily to be played outdoors in informal settings. The first by Richard Strauss, A Little Serenade, and the second by a French composer, Charles Gounod. And then we play some Mozart, the first movement of the Symphony 25 in G minor, which is the theme from Amadeus, the movie from several decades ago. And then we end with a beautiful piece by the English Romantic composer Frederick Delius, certainly an underrepresented composer in our country. The piece is called On Hearing the First Cuckoo in Spring, which we're excited about playing, of course, as we anticipate the first day of spring in a couple days.
Yes, and our weather is warming up accordingly from a rather cold, rainy week. How do Iowans, anyone, how do people enjoy it online?
Yeah, these are virtual performances, and our entire Des Moines Symphony season is virtual this year. The performance is this evening at 7 o'clock, and actually we start some video around 6:30, which gives the public some information about the music and a wonderful detailed explanation from Dr. Eric McIntyre from Grinnell College. It's a free video, which is wonderful. But as far as the concert goes, it starts at 7. Tickets are $20 and available online at dmsymphony.org.
Okay, dmsymphony.org. We want to hear a little bit of what I think your symphony players will be performing. You will be conducting this evening on the way out. But just to make sure, you go to dmsymphony.org and it's clear you buy a ticket and then can watch it on your screen.
Any device you have, you can watch it on. And if people are nervous about how to do all this, once again, on our website, dmsymphony.org, there's an area there on how to stream, and there's detailed instructions for everyone.
Okay, Maestro Joseph Junta, thank you very much of the Des Moines Symphony. Have a wonderful evening as we look forward to spring and your spring serenade this evening. We're going to go out with a little bit of what your performers will be putting out
beautiful
there this evening. Yeah, this is
a beautiful piece by Richard Strauss. Yeah,
Richard Strauss. If my notes are correct, Oboe Concerto and Serenade and Sonatina Number 2 by, in this case, by the Concertgebouw Orchestra. Okay, Maestro Giunta, have a wonderful evening. Thank you for sharing.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, we'll go out with a little different music today. River to River, produced by Rick Brewer, Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Once again, to enjoy that symphony, live symphony orchestra, Des Moines Symphony, dmsymphony.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's go out with more of Richard Strauss. Thank you for joining us.